thank you and tuning. Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Aiden Tong. Today is June 28th, and we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today on Democracy Watch, we are not going to be bringing you any local headlines because we just have so much hot, undercovered current affairs coverage for you. So much. It is out of control. So we just before the show right there, we heard an amazing played for the first time on your airwaves audio doc by News Collective comrade Erika. And we'll be revisiting some of the content of that in the show today. But Erika, could you introduce the first piece that we're going to be hearing? You and Aiden interviewed a lady called Jenny Kwan. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we interviewed MP Jenny Kwan. She's a member of parliament. She's originally from East Vancouver and she's a former MLA. And we, because of the headlines that are, I guess, kind of going viral right now, what with the detention situation along the U.S.-Mexico border, we wanted to pull that into what Canada's role in this is. And so Jenny is going to give some of her insights on that.
All right. So we'll play the interview with Jenny now, and then we'll come back for some questions with our experts afterwards.
So we have a choice to make. And, you know, to the Prime Minister, you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth. You can't say that Canada welcomes you and at the same time not take the real action that is required to reflect that sentiment.
That was MP Jenny Kwan in an interview with Democracy Watch reporters Arika Riaz and myself, Aiden Tong. As former MLA of Vancouver East and a current sitting member of Parliament, she calls out Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for not upholding Canada's international reputation as a safe haven for refugees and asylum seekers, taking a hard stance against the inhumane conditions many migrant families are being subjected to in the United States. Kwan asserts that detainment of children should be explicitly condemned by Canada.
Even former Conservative Minister Chris Alexander is calling for the suspension of the Safe Third Country Agreement. Trump is taking migrant children hostage and putting them in cages to advance his political agenda. The UN Human Rights Commissioner calls this unconscionable. The UNHCR acknowledges Trump's tactics are inhumane. Amnesty International calls it, quote, nothing short of torture. Will the Prime Minister state the obvious that the United States is no longer a safe country for migrant children?
Jenny Kwan is referring to the Safe Third Country Agreement, a bilateral treaty brought into existence by Canada and the U.S. in 2004 to regulate refugee mobility between both countries. Under the agreement, persons seeking refugee status must make their claim in the first country they arrive in, either the United States or Canada, unless they qualify for an exemption. In response to the deplorable action of separating immigrant children from their parents, it has been Jenny Kwan and several civil rights advocacy groups in Canada, including the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association and the Peter Allard School of Law at UBC, that has called for the federal government to suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement. This would recognize the United States as an unsafe country, unable to provide a safe haven for those who face persecution.
And if the agreement was completely suspended, if there was no SDCA, would we then see more refugees coming in?
If the Safe Third Country Agreement was suspended, then what I think we will see is that people will cross to Canada through the official ports of entry, and then there will be order, which is what, by the way, the system was set up to do, for people to cross over, and if you're coming here to seek asylum, you would declare that at the official ports of entry, and then CBSA as well as the RCMP will deal with the situation, and and then unless if there are issues of criminality or gang violence, terrorism, and the like, you know, you will be processed accordingly, and then a claim will be submitted to the Immigration Refugee Board, and then a hearing will be heard to determine whether or not your asylum claim is a valid one, and then things will proceed accordingly in a, what I would say, a orderly fashion.
So seeing as a lot of detention centers are already being maxed out across Canada, would, if SDCA were suspended, and would that not add even more traffic to these detention centers, or would it not overwhelm our hearing system even more?
Well, you've got to ask the question, why are people locked up to begin with? And is that really necessary? You know, people should only be locked up, in my view, if there are issues around criminality, around, you know, safety concerns and so on. And if that's the case, likely they would not be able to make a claim, right? They would actually be deported from the country. But those who are not posing a risk to Canadians, why are they even being locked up to begin with? The government has acknowledged that detention of asylum seekers is wrong, and that they're moving to reducing those numbers. Then you need to go to the premise of the issue and really question why they were even locked up to begin with.
My name is Erika Riaz.
And I'm Aiden Tong.
And that was a report from Democracy Watch with MP Jenny Kwan about the push to suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement and on immigration detention. Keep tuning in for more great local content.
If you are fleeing war and terror, Canada will welcome you. That was Justin Trudeau in 2017. And then last week, Jenny Kwan was in Parliament speaking to Justin Trudeau amongst the rest of the Parliament. And when asked about the situation in the United States, about the human rights violations that are happening in the United States and what Canada can do in response to this by ending the Safe Third Country Agreement, Trudeau responded with, "Canada will not play politics." Jenny Kwan, our East Vancouver representative up at Parliament Hill, repeatedly asked him, "Why isn't Canada acting?" And his only response was, "We don't want to play politics." Aiden, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it was quite interesting that when we did interview her, she was just kind of telling us the Liberal Party isn't following through with, I mean, all this fluffy rhetoric that they always kind of talk about with regards to refugees and asylum seekers. And then when it came to the Conservative Party, they don't have a great track record with this as well. So she was just kind of in this lull as to what both parties were going to do. She's obviously very passionate about this subject, and obviously with, I mean, children being detained in the U.S., it's quite a problem. But for her, I think what spoke to me was the fact that it was her and a refugee advocates in Canada that were really concerned about the hate crimes that have risen in the United States, as well as the xenophobia. And that's something that she pointed out in this interview. And so that's why she wants to suspend the STCA, is because she wants these people, essentially, she wants them to be safe. And this is what Canada should be representing, is we are welcoming to refugees and asylum seekers, and that's what she wants.
So essentially, and we did talk about this in the piece, but the Safe Third Country Agreement, we only sign that with countries that respect human rights. And the only country that we have signed this agreement with is the United States. And so yes, Mr. Trudeau did evade Jenny's questions on this repeatedly. But when we talked to Jenny, we liked how she kind of brought it back to Vancouver and how and why this is a topic and a question that is relevant to Vancouver. A lot of the asylum seekers, most of them are going to Quebec, irregular crossing points in Quebec and Toronto and Eastern Canada. But in 2017, we had about, I think it was 700 asylum seekers cross over actually where Surrey is. So that's 700 people fleeing persecution from the United States coming into Canada, but we didn't deem them refugees because of the Safe Third Country Agreement.
Cool. So, yeah, I find it really interesting how you guys have turned the spotlight from what's happening down in the United States back onto Canada and our relationship with the US. But another consequence of the sort of Trump's policy being put in the spotlight at the moment is that other countries have been forced to reflect on their own treatment of both illegal immigrants and those in their country without documents in a way that is sometimes a little bit unpleasant. And that was the topic of Erika's documentary that we actually heard before the start of Democracy Watch today. Erika, for folks who were not fortunate enough to listen to your doc before the show, who are definitely going to tune in later, take my advice. Could you quickly summarize what you uncovered in the course of your investigations about Canada's own system?
Yeah, so the documentary was called Worse Than Prison, How Vancouver Detains Non-Citizens. How I kind of got into this topic was, obviously we all know that like immigration in the United States is basically going viral in the media, especially in terms of undocumented migrants. And I was like, well, Canada also probably has some undocumented people. It's a big country. And so when I looked into the situation and what's happening with undocumented people in Canada, and I found some really, really chilling things. Like, for example, in the start of 2018, the United States did not have indefinite detention, but Canada did. And I just found that interesting and just so, so horrible that, you know, in Canada, of course, we're very proud of, you know, the whole refugees welcome, I guess, slogan that we've kind of established for ourselves. But at the same time, we don't have the right to be constantly pointing fingers at the United States and being like, oh, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that, when we also are engaging in policies in some ways worse than what's going on in the States. So this doc was just to highlight Canada and specifically Vancouver's detention system.
Yeah, and you do really nicely, I think, in the doc illustrate sort of that hypocrisy between the rainbow image that Canada wants to portray internationally and what is actually going on at home with our policies. But you also interview a lot of everyday Vancouverites on the street about their knowledge of how Vancouver is treating immigrants and sort of asylum detainees here locally. And it sounds as though a lot of people in the general population are deeply unaware of the kinds of treatments that you unveil in your documentary. So I wanted to ask you why you think that disconnect exists between sort of public opinion on what's happening and the realities of our own policies. Is that a lack of information, or is that a lack of engagement on citizens' part? Or what makes us so ignorant of what's going on in our own backyards?
Okay, so like I feel like we're jumping more to the federal level than local Vancouver, but that's okay. So honestly, I feel like it's our PR system, public relations. Like, our federal government spends a lot of money into keeping up, I guess, the facade of the refugees welcome. Like, spreading that slogan and that picture of Canada across the globe, that is an expensive project. So I don't even, like, I guess I don't even fully blame Canadians for not knowing this stuff. Because, for example, when I started the documentary and I was interviewing people on the street, and I was like, hey, did you know there's a detention facility right next to the Vancouver Public Library in the same Library Square Center? And they're like, oh, I had no idea that was there. Is it even really their fault? Because when you Google stuff like this, 300 Georgia Street detention facility, nothing really shows up. And so that in itself, I feel like, is a testament to how much Canada puts into trying to keep this stuff in the dark.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, in your documentary, you actually do talk quite specifically about Canada's identity of itself as being diametrically opposed to the policies of, in particular, of sort of the new right-wing movements and of Trump's America. After talking to Jenny and after the investigation that you did, do you think that self-image in Canada is changing? Do you think that the world's image of Canada is changing in light of these sorts of things coming out?
Honestly, and of course, this is just my opinion. I'm stepping off the pedestal of journalist for the day. I feel like it's not yet. Like, of course, there are voices, independent, kind of sort of out of the mainstream voices, like Jenny Kwan and like so many others, who are working to, I guess, spread the truth. But at the same time, the worse things get in the United States, in places like the United States, the easier it is to be able to point the finger and be like, it's us. not them who's doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you for your documentary, which counters that in some pretty important ways, I think. For people who didn't manage to listen to it, please check it out online. Arika, what is the name of your documentary?
It's Worse Than Prison, How Vancouver Detains Non-Citizens.
All right, you know what to Google. You can find it in iTunes and Stitcher. Democracy Watch is about to take a short break, and we'll be back after a couple of PSAs to talk with you about Vancouver's new randomized ballot system.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
I haven't left my bedroom for days. It's because I've been reading my favorite magazine. It's called Discorder, and the June issue is out now.
This month in Discorder, you'll read about the indigenous burlesque group Virago Nation, emerging hip-hop artist Rude Nala, DIY artist-run space Duplex, Dim Cinema's experimental moving art programs, Moniker Press's experimental risograph printing, toxic masculinity as defined by Weva, and so much more. You can even pull out the June event calendar and flip it for the Music Waste Festival schedule June 7th to 10th. Thank you to our advertisers Timber Concerts, Mint Records, The Rickshaw Theater, The Rio, Cinematech, Hexistential Festival, AMS, Queer Arts Festival, and Blueprint Events.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with NDP MP Jenny Kwan on how Canada treats its detained non-citizens, which was followed by a discussion with an audio doc maker and News Collective member, Arika Riaz, on her documentary Worse Than Prisons about a couple immigrant detention centers in Vancouver. So we're now going to change the focus a bit to municipal politics. As we all know, we have an election on October 20th. So we're going to hear a report on Vancouver's new randomized ballot system, which will be in place for this October 20th election. I spoke with political scientist Jack Lucas about this new policy, and I'll let you guys take a listen to the interview and come up with your own thoughts on it.
You take the challenge here. Democracy Watch questions
you. That was well phrased.
Think for yourself.
Hello, I'm Alex DeBoer, CITR's current affairs coordinator and member of CITR's News Collective. So, we have a municipal election that is less than 3 months away. In an effort to make this election fairer, both for candidates and voters, Councillor Andrea Reimer introduced a motion to randomize the ballot order. This motion passed in council on June 6th. What that means is that instead of candidates appearing on the ballot in alphabetical order, according to last name, so A, B, C, D, E, and so on, the order of candidates will now be random. Since this motion passed, general perception has been quite favorable. Those who think it won't make a difference also seem to agree that it couldn't hurt. But is that true? In a recent article in the New Spirit titled, Should Ballot Order Be Randomized in Vancouver?, co-authors Jack Lucas and Charles Tessier use a new database of election results from cities across Western Canada to examine the effects of alphabetic ballot ordering, or what is known as the Aardvark advantage. In theory, the problem with the Aardvark advantage is that voters will simply scan the list of names and choose the first names they recognize as they move down the list from top to bottom. And this issue can become exacerbated with a complicated ballot with, say, 50 or 40 people to vote for, such as will be the case in the upcoming Vancouver municipal election. Authors Lucas and Tessier have, however, disputed this understanding of the Aardvark advantage as being overly simplistic. In their analysis, they found the Aardvark advantage gives a small advantage only in cases where candidates' party affiliations aren't clearly labeled. This is key. it means that the aardvark advantage is much more pronounced in elections that involve nonpartisanship, low-profile races, or low amounts of information for voters. Essentially, in elections where voters don't know the candidates and don't know which party they belong to, or if they do, they don't know what that party stands for, the aardvark advantage will be in effect. Even in those cases, the advantage is only around 2 to 4%, so it's still quite small. What Lucas and Tessier warn is that implementing a randomized ballot system will simply replace one unfair system with another. They argue that instead of the aardvark advantage, now a random selection of names that get placed at the top of the ballot order will be given a slight advantage. To prevent this, they make two recommendations. One, to implement a rotating ballot system, and two, and most importantly, to provide voters with all the information they need to make an informed decision. I reached out to one of these authors in Calgary, Jack Lucas. Lucas is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and the director of the Urban Policy Program at the School of Public Policy at the University of Calgary. Here's the interview. First off, Vancouver has up till this June, with the passing of Andrea Reimer's motion to randomize the ballot order, had an alphabetical ordering system. And this system has been criticized because of a phenomenon called the aardvark advantage, which you talk about in your article. I'm wondering if you can just explain what that is.
Sure. So the phenomenon that we call the aardvark advantage in this article is the advantage that people get from their position at the top of the ballot. And if you imagine a voter in Vancouver, to try and understand how this aardvark advantage might emerge, you can imagine a voter who goes to the polls, has to select 10 city council candidates from a list of 30 or 40 or even 50 names. And so they start at the top of the ballot, and they start to work their way down through the list. And as they go, they select the names that they recognize and remember that they want to vote for. And if you don't have very much information for voters on the ballot to help them remember who's who, it can sometimes be the case that as they go through the list, they'll mistakenly vote for somebody at the top of the ballot, someone they recognize, and they will have exhausted their votes or the votes they want to cast by the time they get to the bottom. And so what that means is people who are at the top, because people tend to work through the list from top to bottom, might have an unfair advantage. So that's what we call the aardvark advantage, simply because if the ballot is ordered alphabetically, then if your last name happens to be aardvark, then you're in the lucky situation of almost always being at the very top of the list.
Right, right. And so with this reform to randomize the ballot order so that it's no longer based on an alphabetical order, it seems like the public has reacted favorably and sort of acknowledges that this aardvark advantage is real. But in your article, you explain that this advantage carries real caveats, and I'm wondering if you can explain what those are.
Sure. So there's two sides of the question when you're thinking about whether a ballot order should change. You can think about whether the aardvark advantage is a real problem. That's the one thing. And then you can think about what are the consequences going to be of randomizing the order of the names. So in terms of the consequences of randomizing the order of the names, the conversation in Vancouver, as far as I've followed it, has generally suggested that this is a pretty harmless reform. If there's any chance that the aardvark advantage is real, we may as well randomize the order of the ballot, and it's not going to do any harm, and it might help the problem. But it is worth remembering that a randomly ordered list of 40 or 50 names does create some problems of its own, the most obvious of which is that it's kind of confusing. If you have 10 people you want to vote for, and you have them in mind, and you can find them on a alphabetically ordered list, that's pretty easy to do. Not necessarily very easy, but it's easy enough. When you have to find those names amidst others in a random order, it's a little bit harder. And so actually, if there is this phenomenon of people going down the ballot from top to bottom and voting for names as they go, our expectation is that you're going to see it be more pronounced with a randomly ordered ballot than you would for an alphabetically ordered ballot, just because of the increased difficulty involved in finding the 10 people you want to vote for on that big, long list.
Right. Okay. So with a randomly ordered ballot, it actually makes the problem worse.
That's right. Our expectation and is that to the extent that the name order problem is a problem, it's going to be more pronounced with a random ballot than an alphabetical ballot.
Right. So another component of the Aardvark advantage is that it may discourage people with names low on the alphabet from even running for office, which I thought was really interesting, and I hadn't considered that. And I know this is something Andrea Reimer has emphasized. And you do have a graph in your article that shows that there is evidence that this Aardvark advantage arms race, as you call it, has happened in Vancouver over the years, but that the phenomenon is mostly linked to nonpartisan candidates. So can you tell me why that is?
Right. So what we found was that, as you say, the people, we do see more candidates with last names early in the alphabet today than we did in Vancouver in the 1940s or 1950s. Mm-hmm. And the obvious reason you might think that that would happen is that the parties are getting wise to this Aardvark advantage effect, and they're trying to run candidates with these early in the alphabet names. But what we found when we look at the data is that actually this whole change over time, which is pretty modest overall, but that change is driven almost exclusively by independent candidates. So mm-hmm. why is this? We don't know. I can speculate that if there is some sort of scare-off effect of this alphabetical advantage, if people think, well, my name is Mr. Zorn, and so there's no chance I'm going to get elected anyway, so I may as well not bother, perhaps you would see that more among independent candidates than candidates who are being recruited by political parties and encouraged to run. But honestly, I don't know, and I think it'll require a little bit more in-depth investigation to figure out who these independent candidates are and why we've seen this change over time. But that does seem to be the key driver of the change. And like I say, it's pretty modest overall anyway.
Right, right. But the theory is that perhaps it's because parties are choosing people whose names are higher on the alphabet because of this perceived or real phenomenon.
That would be our first theory, but we right. don't see that really borne out in the evidence. One thing I can say is that the NPA in its earlier years does seem to have been pretty good at choosing candidates with early in the alphabet names. Mm. You have to dig into that further to know if it's really a fluke or if there's something really going on there. If you look at the Vancouver historians of Vancouver politics have often pointed out that it did seem that the NPA was choosing candidates in the early years who had these early in the alphabet names, but that seems to have, in general, that seems to have evened out over time. So since the 1970s, we're not able to pick up any clear evidence that the parties are getting hip to the Aardvark advantage and changing their strategy as a result.
Right, right. And you also point out that, like, in the 70s, what was the rule they changed? I have it here. That you had to add party labels to the candidates' names. And there was also coincided with the reemergence of a competitive party system in the city.
Yeah, this, I think, is actually the most important finding in our little report, mm-hmm. which is that since the mid-1970s, there's essentially no evidence for the Aardvark advantage in Vancouver. So prior to the 1970s, we see really clear evidence that people at the top of the ballot did have an advantage over people who were lower down on the ballot. And that seems to have established a line of thinking in Vancouver that this was a real problem. Because at one point in the city's history, it was a real problem. But since the 1970s, that problem has, as far as we can tell, basically disappeared. And the reason for that is because of two factors, we think. One is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the party system in Vancouver had reinvigorated. You had the party called Team and COPE, and those were the initial competitors to NPA, and then subsequently we see the emergence of Vision Vancouver and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that has given voters really important clues about who they might want to support in on a ballot of 40 or 50 names. The second thing, which is also important and closely linked to this, is that on ballots today in Vancouver, the party label of each candidate is actually printed next to the name on the ballot itself. So unlike prior to 1974, when you had to actually memorize the names of the party candidates you wanted to vote for, if you wanted to vote for party candidates, now you can just go into the voting station and say, look, I want to vote for NPA candidates or Vision Vancouver candidates. I'm just going to go down the list and vote for those candidates. And you don't necessarily need to know as much about each of the specific names. So that information is really vital. We know it's vital from other levels of government for voters and for giving the voters the information they need to make their choices. And it seems like once that information was available to voters in Vancouver, the aardvark advantage essentially disappears.
Right. So it sounds like you're saying that, you know, once candidates are grouped into parties that stand for something, people can more easily identify who they want to vote for based on those party beliefs rather than the individual candidates who may have more complex individual platforms.
Exactly. If you know which party you want to vote for and you're able to identify the candidates for that party on the ballot itself, you're just in much better shape for being able to cast a complex ballot in a way that you're comfortable with.
Right. Another thing I thought was really interesting in your article is that Vancouver experimented with randomized ballots in 1993. Can you tell me about that and why that initiative didn't stick?
Yeah, this is a little forgotten tidbit in the history of Vancouver, and I didn't see it discussed very much during this recent debate about randomization. But in 1993, almost exactly the same thing happened as we've seen happen this year. Concerns grew about the alphabetical order advantage, and as a result, the ballot was randomized, and subsequent to the election, there were complaints about that randomly ordered ballot being confusing and difficult to work with, and so the ballot was changed back to alphabetical order. But I don't know that much about the details of how that change happened. There's really very little reporting on it in the newspapers of the day. I haven't been able to find much by way of archival materials related to that event. So it's a bit of a historical tidbit, but it would be worth exploring given that this recent change is happening in Vancouver again. It'd be nice to know a little more about the experience in 1993.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've listed how, or you've explained how the randomized ballot sort of creates a new set of advantages in replacing the alphabetized system. And your recommendation is that instead, or in addition to the randomized ballot, Vancouver adopt a rotating ballot system. Can you tell me a bit about what that is?
Sure. So if you think about the way the randomized ballot's going to work in Vancouver, it'll be the order of the names will be drawn from a hat, and or from a box or from something randomly, mm-hmm. and you'll get an overall name order based on who gets pulled from the hat. And that will then be the order of the names on the ballot for the entire city. So no matter where you go to vote in the city, you'll grab your ballot, and that will be the order of the names. And the effect of that, as we say in the report, is that really you're just picking a different set of winners, right? If the ballot order advantage is a real thing, then instead of being a winner because your last name is aardvark, you're a winner because your last name happened to be the first one that was drawn from the hat. So the way to get around this is to have a different order of names at each polling station across the city. It's also possible to have a different order of names on every single ballot, but that gets a little complicated. They do it that way in Calgary. But in a number of American cities, they just divide up the order by polling station. Each polling station has a different order. So if my name is at the top of the ballot in one polling station, then at the polling station down the road, I might be in the middle of the ballot. And so everybody kind of gets their turn at the top of the ballot, and you even out whatever advantages might exist for the top of the ballot candidate. Those get evened out because you're never at the top of the ballot in more than one polling station.
Right. That makes sense. And that's not something that the city has in the works, though.
No, this was discussed, and I believe that Councillor Reimer mentioned it as something that she would favor, but the Vancouver City Charter appears to only allow for either an alphabetical ballot or a randomized ballot with the same order across the city. So my understanding is that it would require a change to the city charter to actually allow for something like this, which is why it's pretty unlikely to happen before the fall election.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why the city charter won't allow this?
No, the option to introduce a randomized ballot was put into the city charter a long time ago, and I'm not really sure why it was introduced, and there's probably not that many people around who remember, but at the time, I believe the city of Vancouver wanted to have the option. Perhaps it was before the 1993 reform, and subsequent to that, this system of rotating ballots has really become more prominent, and so it probably just wasn't on the radar at the time quite the same way that it is today.
Right. With the need for voters to have the information, all the information about all the candidates and all the parties in order to make an informed decision, which you outline as being the major way to have a fair election, rather than like whether the ballot is alphabetized or randomized or whatever system is used. And you suggest that the major forces that can spread information to people who are voting are the media, the political parties, and the election administrators. And it seems to me the major force among those three is the media. And I was just wondering if you wanted to comment on whether you think Vancouver's media is robust enough to provide voters with the information they need to make informed decisions when casting their ballots, especially in an election with 40 or 50 names that may be especially confusing.
Well, I'm currently a resident of the city of Calgary, and so I feel somewhat presumptuous commenting on the state of Vancouver's media system. But I would say that it is possible, even in spite of the complexity of the ballot, given the party system, there are opportunities for Vancouver media to cover the election in a way that's really useful for voters, really by focusing on those parties, and then also focusing on independent candidates who look to be competitive. You know, in the mayoral race, it looks like there's going to be a quite competitive independent candidate who's not running under any party label, Kennedy Stewart. And
yep.
There will need to be a lot of coverage of Kennedy Stewart's position to kind of match the coverage that'll go on of MPA and Vision Vancouver and so forth. There are ways that, in addition to the media, that these other actors can do more or less work to inform the electorate. In our most recent election in Calgary, for example, the city election office made little two-minute videos of every single candidate in the city. Any candidate who wanted to participate was free to participate. It was exactly the same image of every candidate, kind of leveled the playing field as far as image quality and production quality and all of those things go. And every candidate had an opportunity to stand in front of this camera and speak for 2 minutes about their vision for the city. And my understanding from talking to the election officials after the election is that those videos were viewed a lot. And so there are opportunities like that for city election administrators to get involved in a way that's totally neutral and not politicized at all, and help to inform voters about the options that they have. But I do agree with you that the key actor here is the media, and we all of us, political scientists, media, everybody else, can get caught up in the horse race of it all sometimes, and that's all perfectly legitimate and justifiable, but it's nice when it is accompanied by clear information for voters about what the candidates stand for and who they claim to represent, and that those kinds of bits of information help voters make up their minds about who they want to choose and reduce the chance that they're going to go into the voting station and accidentally make a choice for somebody at the top of the ballot who they didn't actually intend to vote for.
All right. That was an interview that I did with Jack Lucas, a political scientist and professor at the University of Calgary, on the topic of Vancouver's new randomized ballot policy for the upcoming October 20th municipal election. We're going to take a real quick break and then return with more Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
Support the women of the Downtown East Side and spring into the Scotiabank Charity Challenge on June 24th. Join the Downtown East Side Women's Center in crowdsourcing funds and spreading awareness of their organization, which provides safe space, emergency shelter, basic essentials, and a continuum of support to marginalized women. Go to www.dewc.ca/run-4-DEWC for more information.
Damascus returns for its fourth year. Join us on July 31st as this fundraiser brings the soul of Syria to the heart of Vancouver with music, storytelling, dancing, wine, and food. All proceeds go to support queer Syrian refugees. For more information and tickets, visit eveningindamascus.com.
All right, and this is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. So we've heard an interview with NDP Member of Parliament Jenny Kwan about Canada's detention facilities for non-citizens. We've also heard on this show an interview with University of Calgary political scientist Jack Lucas about the effects of the potential effects of Vancouver's new randomized ballot system, which will be in effect for our upcoming municipal election. So we're now going to hear a report from last night's Green Party nomination meeting to continue on the local politics kick. Well, everything we do is local politics, but to continue on the election kick, rather. So I was at the nomination meeting last night, which was on Main and about 15th. And I collected some tape and I had a chance to talk with Adrian Carr, who's the incumbent Green City Councillor. So let's take a listen to my report and you can hear about the nomination meeting results.
Hi, everyone. Thanks everyone for coming out. I'm Adrian Carr. I topped the polls in the last election, more votes than any councillor in the history of Vancouver. Because they say, I work hard, I listen to people, I am fair and balanced, and I put public interest first. I decided to not run for mayor, but for council, because people said to me overwhelmingly, we can't afford to lose your voice in council chambers. People want me in those chambers, but it's in your hands to share my name is on the ballot, and I trust you to do that, and I trust you to pick a fabulous team of candidates to get elected on October 20th. Consider incumbency. It really helps to have incumbents running. They've got the knowledge. It's really good to consider nominating people who have worked for years to build our party. I've worked with P5, for example, for years. It really makes a difference. It's smart to include young, diverse candidates that reflect the community at large. Nominate me, and I pledge to campaign with every candidate, every bit of my energy, every bit of my time.
That was incumbent Green Party City Councillor Adrian Carr, going over her allotted one-minute speech time at last night's Green Party nomination meeting on Main Street. On the evening of Wednesday, June 28th, seven Green Party City Council hopefuls delivered speeches to party members. Those seven were Adrian Carr, Pete Fry, Denise Brennan, Terry Martin, Francois Ronette, Mike Weeb, and David Wong. After City Council nomination speeches came the four Park Board nominees, Dave Demirs, Camille Dumont, Stuart McKinnon, and Mash Sailhuman. These nominees were followed by the last round of speeches by six school board nominees, Lois Chan Pedley, Nicholas Chernin, Alex Dow, Ralph Fratz, Janet Fraser, and Estrelita Gonzalez. After each of the 17 one-minute nomination speeches concluded, I was able to chat with Adrian Carr outside the voting hall. Could you tell me a bit about your platform?
Well, the platform's going to be developed once we get our candidates in place. That's who develops the platform, because they have to run on that platform. But you can bet, on a council perspective, housing's number one. Affordable housing is just the biggest crisis in this city, and we have to take much bolder and much different action in order to get the kind of affordable housing matched to local incomes that Vancouver needs.
You had considered running for mayor because you had a lot of popularity and you had a good chance of winning, according to some political scientists, but you weren't able to get endorsement from center-left parties. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so basically I was urged to run by people within the public just saying, look at this, as we need this, there's a change election happening. The current mayor is not running again, so this is the perfect opportunity to step forward. So the first thing I did was assess my own party support, and I got 100% support. Then I started to look at polling, and there were a couple of polls done, and I was the most popular of any potential candidate for mayor by far, like way above anyone else. But then it's all about the competition, because people said to me, look, I really want you to be mayor, there's a risk, and what if you lose, and then we lose your voice at the council chambers? So they didn't want that. So what was the risk? I figured the more candidates on the center left, the higher the risk. So I approached all the other parties on the center left, and unfortunately didn't get any of those parties to support me. And 1 week after asking for it, Vision said they were going to run a candidate. Then Kennedy Stewart stepped in, and I gathered with NDP support, and Shauna Sylvester was already there, and now Cope is thinking of running a mayor candidate. So all of that means that the vote gets divided, like it did last October in the by-election when there were five candidates on the center-left and they got two-thirds of the vote, but Hector Bremner, the NPA candidate, won with 27% of the vote. I didn't want to repeat that scenario, so that was what made me decide. I'll go for council. That's what the public really wants me to do. They want me in that council chamber, and running for mayor is too risky in a crowded field.
Right, and so you talk about, if elected to council again, being a sort of de facto mayor. What exactly does that mean?
I'll ask Charlie Smith of the Georgia Strait, because he's the one that said
okay.
it.
I read it in your
yeah, that's your right. It came straight in the column by Charlie Smith, which I found amusing, because the point really is there's not very many incumbents running for council. So Heather Deal from Vision, so none of the other Vision councillors are running, myself as a Green, potentially a couple of the NPA, because one and potentially two are not going to run. So that means those with incumbency, those who have the knowledge of how the system works, how City Hall works, who the staff are, the whole process, there's no learning curve there. You're up to snuff already. So that gives an advantage. And it does mean, especially if you're top the polls, which I did last time, it does give you influence amongst others at the council table, including the mayor. And the mayor's just one amongst equals. It's only one vote. So there is a potential, I think, by my own incumbency, my own popularity, and hopefully by having other Greens at the table with me, that I will play a very influential role in the next council.
Cool. I just have one final question, then I'll let you go. I'm wondering about the sort of spectrum of right to left politics in the city. So a lot of people, particularly on the right, sort of say that there isn't a right-to-left division. It's just different approaches. Do you see the Greens as being more on the right or left, or do you think there isn't really that kind of binary here in Vancouver?
Yeah, I think there is a binary here in Vancouver. You have to understand that at council, most of the decisions that are made are unanimous. It's just a no-brainer to everybody is voting for them. But on some of the critical issues, like whether or not you spend money to combat the opioid crisis or not, there was a big debate about that, with the NPA looking like they weren't going to vote for it. They haven't voted on some of the motions I brought forward to say no to the pipeline, the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So they're more entrenched in the traditional fossil fuel kind of economy that I think those on the progressive side are wanting to see us move beyond. So on some of the social issues, on some of the economic issues, and certainly even on some of the environmental issues when it comes, for example, to combating climate change, I have arguments all the time with some of the NPA councillors about whether there is climate change or not. I can't believe that someone in government is not already there and accepting that as the biggest crisis of our time in general for the planet. So there are left positions and there are right positions, and I think that that the way politics has shaken down in Vancouver, you've tended to see the NPA on that right side. A vision has said it straddles the middle, and then you see parties like the Greens, who, interestingly, some people have said are on the left, but the real actual reality of voters is that we draw from both the left and the right. People who understand common sense and wanting to see a healthier environment and thinking about the future, not just about the present, and grounding decisions in facts.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and good luck to you. Yeah,
thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah, Carr agrees that there is a political binary in Vancouver, and that her party draws support from both the left and the right. I'm very eager to see what progressive politics means for the Green Party's housing and poverty policies as they develop their platform, and where that will be situated on the spectrum of left to right. As votes roll in, nominees are announced around 11 p.m. Adrian Carr, Pete Fry, Mike Wiebe, and David Wong, the four candidates endorsed by the Green Party, are the ones elected to run for City Council. For School Board, Chan Pedley, Chernin, Fraser, and Gonzalez will be running, and for Park Board, Demers, Dumont, and McKinnon. And with these election results, the Green Party is breaking their agreement with the Vancouver and District Labour Council to elect a progressive City Council, School Board, and Park Board. They entered an agreement to only nominate three candidates for Park Board, School Board, and City Council in order to have an overall higher chance of a progressive candidate earning a seat in each of these chambers. By nominating four City Councillors and four School Board members, they added two more nominees to the ballot than they had promised. I'm Alex DeBoer, signing out.
Okay, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. That was a report from last night's Green Party nomination meeting. All the results were listed. So one thing I noticed while there, to my surprise, was that Glenn Chernin, who is the rabble-rouser of the NPA, who was not elected but ran for their position of mayor, his brother, Nicholas Chernin, was running for the Greens for Park Board and was elected.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, these Chernins are everywhere. and we have Zubin in studio here, too. Zubin and I were the ones who went to the NPA mayoral election meeting. So I sent him a Facebook message and to let him know this municipal gossip. I was like, who can I tell this to? Literally no one except for Zubin. So what are your thoughts on this, Zubin?
It's quite interesting. okay. As pointed out in the Georgia Strait article by Charlie Smith, Glenn Chernin apparently considered running for the Greens before choosing to run for the NPA. Previously, both brothers were part of the Glenn Chernin-founded, non-developer-money-founded Cedar Party in the last civic election, which was unsuccessful, as many of you have probably never heard of it. however, you may have heard of their one stunt that got some news attention because they protested the bike lane expansions on Point Grey Road by driving down them in their Dodge Charger and Camaro Z something. But either way, it's quite ironic now that Nicholas Chernin has won a nomination from the Green Party, a party which you would usually associate with environmental causes such as the reduction in carbon emissions,
such as
which
from
classic cars are not known for, nor are protesting bike lanes.
Yeah, that's weird. And I think it relates nicely to the end of the piece we just heard, the report from the Green Party nomination meeting, which is this question that I brought up. Where is the Green Party situated in the political binary? And I mean, assuming that Nicholas no longer is into old-timey cars, but maybe he is. Like, I don't know. It seems like this party is sort of
probably has a Tesla now.
Probably has a Tesla now.
Now he's an environmentalist.
Yeah. I guess we'll just see, like, where they're environmentally progressive, but, like, are mm-hmm. they socially progressive, really? They say they are, but honestly, every party says they are.
Yeah.
Literally every party. The NPA, Hector Bremner with Yes Vancouver, I believe.
Yeah.
His
Love
new platform.
Or everything, or we need open whatever.
Yeah. Oh, also, as an update, his party has officially launched. I believe it's called Yes Vancouver. I mean, most people knew that already. Like, that was anticipated, but it is called Yes Vancouver. So that's a thing.
But, I mean, it was interesting that Nick Chernin's brief, candidate description did sound quite progressive, and he talked about having, like, kids who've gone through, like, bullying issues and experience coming out and other such things. So compared to what his brother talked about at the NPA, it does seem like at least, like, he touched on some considered socially progressive issues.
That's true. I guess we'll just have to see.
Wait and see.
Man, this election is exciting. I would like to say before we come to a close that the News Collective here at CITR, which you are listening to, is launching a podcast called Seeking Office. And we are very excited about it. At least I am. It will be coverage of the municipal election, which is just less than 4 months away, 3 months away. October 20th is when it is. Stay tuned for that. There'll be social media information coming out soon to direct you to where you can download it, which will be anywhere you can download podcasts. And it will be available on Tuesday. So stay tuned for more information on that. And thank you for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. The next show, which you should stay tuned for, is called Flashback with Alec Christensen. So stay tuned and thanks for listening.